Welcome to episode 43 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is William Volk, technical producer of one of the best-selling video games ever, Return to Zork, and the developer and producer of The Climate Trail. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. The Climate Trail was released in August of 2019 and is modeled after the best-selling game of all time, The Oregon Trail. It has 5-star ratings across the board and can be downloaded for free for almost any platform. The setting is a post-climate-changed world. If you want an unprecedented opportunity to connect with key stakeholders and explore what's next in the utilities sector, join me at GridConnect in Washington, D.C., December 10th through 12th. I'll be recording an episode of The Climate Champions live the morning of the 10th, followed by world-class experts exploring diverse perspectives and uncovering market innovations poised to redraw the electric utility landscape. Secure your spot at GridConnect by registering now at GridConnect. That's an X, not a C, .com. William graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a BA in physics and astronomy. He later earned an MA in physics and computer engineering at the University of New Hampshire. After graduation, he briefly left game development to pursue a normal career as an adult, but soon returned to bring us some of the most breakthrough games of the last 40, yes, 40 years. And now he's returned to bring us The Climate Trail. You have to try it. My advice is to save early and save often. That's how I finally won. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat. I'm talking to William Volk. He's the technical producer of the game Return to Zork, and he's the developer and producer of The Climate Trail, a new,
totally free game that takes place in a dystopian post-climate apocalyptic world, and it's modeled after the Oregon Trail, which is the most successful educational game in history, having sold 65 million copies.
Thank you for bailing me out on that one. You've had a very accomplished career doing video games for many, many years, and now you've taken those skills and you've aimed that at climate change. Can you talk about what motivated you to do something with regard to climate change?
Yes. Well, first of all, I have a degree in physics, and I have a brother who's a climatologist, meteorologist, and a wife who used to work for the EPA. So I've followed climate change for a long time. I was reading a short story called A Full Life. It's actually mentioned on the website, about a young girl being shuffled about because of the ongoing climate disaster. It takes place several years from now. And I realized that that resembled to me the story that I've been hearing about climate refugees in general. And I tend to get wrapped up into a lot of discussions online about climate change, a lot of debates with people who are climate deniers. And I decided that I could better utilize my time by applying my background in game design and in educational games. I spent 5 years at a very large educational software startup in San Diego called Lightspan. So I could apply that by creating a game on climate. And I wanted to basically make the game completely free, suitable for schools, enjoyable, but also moving. So I decided to build the Climate Trail.
When was that?
It started in June. I knew a lot about the Oregon Trail because when I was at Lightspan, I actually visited MECC, MEC, the company that was the publisher of the Climate Trail. I visited them in probably 95 or 96. And so I knew what the Oregon Trail was all about, but I wanted to make this more than just a remake of the Oregon Trail. My inspiration was a movie during my childhood that basically shocked me about the dangers of nuclear war, and that movie was On the Beach. On the Beach doesn't show any nuclear war. What it shows is survivors coping with the fact that they too will eventually be dying from the effects of the nuclear war. It's a movie about the acceptance of disaster, of the railing against what's happened, but the acknowledgement that this is happening. And it was a very emotionally moving movie. So what I decided to do was to build a game, The Climate Trail, and weave in both the science and the gameplay, but also a visual novel about characters in the game so that people would basically feel empathetic towards the characters in the game and the world they're living in. And I'll be expanding upon that as revisions of the game occur.
Maybe that will soon be the world we are living in.
Yeah. One of the things about the climate trail is interesting is when I started doing the climate trail, I had a lot of technical knowledge about climate change and obviously the physics of it, the carbon, CO2 absorption spectrum, all the science. What I didn't realize was so much of the body of evidence now, particularly from people who have studied this, is that we're on track for a very bad world. The IPCC, the International Protocol on Climate Change, the UN organization's predictions and models for climate, are optimistic. They tend to ignore feedback loops, and we're seeing feedback loops take place. I uncovered a lot of papers like What Lies Beneath is a particular good article, a collection of articles, and we look like we're going to sail right past 2 degrees centigrade warming all the way to 4 degrees centigrade warming. And the scenario that I painted in the climate trail more and more becomes possible reality. And I didn't feel that way when I started the project. This has sort of happened during the project. So in a way, to be honest, it's a little bit sad and depressing.
Okay, so this is going to be one of those episodes where I don't sleep for a few days afterwards, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to be more optimistic. I don't know if you've ever watched a show, The Newsroom. It was on HBO. There's a scene where an EPA guy named Toby gets on, and Toby is asked about climate, and Toby says, well, imagine you're in a car in the garage, and the engine's been running. That's a situation we've been in. And the news reporter says, well, I guess we could just turn off the car and open the door. And he goes, well, you've already passed into a state of unconsciousness. And the point is, I think Toby was probably more right than wrong. What matters now is, can we prevent disaster? Probably not. Can we change how bad the disaster will be? Probably so. And we should. We should take every effort. And also, there's hope if we do many big things, but people need to be shocked. People are complacent about it. Plus, it's more than what individual people do. I was in a discussion about jet travel this morning with someone, and it's easy to blame people who have to fly on business. I had that experience in 2016 where I had to fly on business a lot. But the work that should have been done to create carbon neutral fuels for jet aircraft should have been done decades ago. And it's possible, but it hasn't been done. And so what I'm trying to do is make people really care about the issue and frankly be a little bit scared and upset about it, the way that Greta Thunberg is and when she yells at the UN. I think she did a great job of expressing how she felt and how her generation felt. And I want the climate trail to be impactful, which is one of the reasons I decided to make it completely free and give it away. And by completely free, I mean no advertising in the game, no in-game purchasing. The game sells for $0. The game's on all platforms. That's important because if I want to make an impact here, I have to make it accessible.
So I salute you for doing that. Can you talk a little bit about the game? What aspects does it have in it that reflects climate change? Is it just the future, or is there something about what we can do about it now?
Well, at the very end of the game, I have some pages. I was given to me by 350.org. Bill McKibben actually tweeted about the game and said, I think the quote was, I don't know anything about video games, but this sounds really interesting. So with their permission, I use their pages, and I'm going to expand upon that. In fact, I think I'm going to add a menu item, which basically is a reference on climate that includes things you can do as a menu you can get to in the game at any time. Right now, it happens at the end of the game, whether you succeed or not. And in this game, success is not exactly what you think it is, but I don't want to give that away. The game also starts off with an introduction to the characters that you can skip, but the introduction has the three characters talking about themselves. One of the characters is a scientist named Catherine, who is named after the NASA mathematician. And she talks about climate change and also how it went bad. I wanted to explain climate change, which everyone does, shows a picture, a diagram of the sunlight coming into the earth being reflected as infrared and being absorbed by carbon dioxide molecules and other molecules. But she also talks about how it went south. And what she talks about is feedback loops, such as the decrease in the Arctic ice, changing the albedo of the ocean. One of the big ones is fires. We have a wildfire situation in California, as we know. One major wildfire in California equals the amount of CO2 we might have reduced for all our efforts. And eventually we hit the situation where in the game it talks about the burn. The burn refers to a situation where wildfires become so numerous and so massive that they can't be fought. And what happens is you have a massive amount of carbon release, which drives temperatures, which drives more wildfires. Basically, a real disaster.
And other feedback loops as well.
Yeah, another feedback loop. I also mentioned the Amazon burn that's occurring now. I even got permission from a photographer to use that famous picture of Greenland where they're driving the dog sleds over a frozen lake that's covered with water. So I mentioned the Greenland ice melt. I mentioned permafrost melting. And that actually plays a role when she talks about what caused people to die. Because in the game, based on stuff like What Lies Beneath, it talks about a massive die-off of animals, die-off of agriculture, die-off of people. And a lot of that is based on diseases being released from the permafrost that haven't been around for thousands of years, based on stuff like the wet bulb temperature situation. People aren't familiar with that. One of the problems with people, myself included, we tend to think in linear terms. 120 degrees is worse than 110 linearly. But the problem is there's a thing called the wet bulb temperature. And I mentioned this and talk about this in the beginning of the game. What wet bulb temperature refers to is a thermometer that typically, traditionally, was mounted on a pole so it could be swung around like a toy with cotton at the end of the thermometer on the bulb soaked in water. And what the wet bulb temperature measures is how cool you can cool that thermometer through evaporation, which is exactly how we cool ourselves. And at a wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees centigrade or 95 degrees Fahrenheit, wet bulb temperature, not actual temperature, basically above that, you die within an hour. And we've come close. We've come very close in parts of Iran and parts of the Middle East. But it's just now, and I hate to say this because it sounds so awful, and I don't even want it to happen, but we're close to having a situation where a major area hits a wet bulb temperature that kills. I read somewhere in the United Emirates now, they're air conditioning walkways, outside walkways. They're pumping cold air where people walk between buildings to prevent people from dying. We all know about the heat wave in Europe in 2003, where 30,000, 40,000 people died. Imagine if that happened in America. That would have been, people would have been like crazy about it. But it happened, and not many people talk about it. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of discussion at the beginning of the game on the science and what happened. And besides the scientist, then there are two other characters. One is a ex-military guy who was involved with, and he talks about resource wars. He touches upon this. Resource wars refers to the fact that if a country actually ends up in a situation where there's massive droughts and they can't raise crops and all that, they are more likely to go into conflict with other countries. We see some of that in the Middle East with the Syrian situation, where farmers, after years of drought, fled to the cities and created a revolt and all that mess. We are seeing right now that most of the Central American refugees, particularly from countries like Guatemala, are coming because the crops have failed. They feel they have no alternative. They have no way of growing anything where they are. So the whole beginning of the game talks about that. There's a young girl in the game who is being shepherded by the military guy. She's 18, she's 19, and she talks about how her family passed away during a heat wave and how they were already susceptible to it and so on. It's pretty sad but depressing. And then we move into the game itself, where we cover what they have to do to survive. They're going to basically travel from Atlanta to Canada along the ruins of a highway, and there are people who helped them along the way, and this is where the gameplay occurs.
So I think we need a climate trail too. Here's my idea.
Okay.
They can go backwards in time and start making key decisions that could have stopped this from happening. What do you think?
Well, I was thinking about, there's a fellow I know named Chris Crawford. He's a game designer. He did a game called Balance of Power. He also did a game called Balance of the Planet a long time ago. I saw a game recently on a crazy game, very difficult to play, on Middle East Peace, which is a similar idea, which is basically put yourself into a position of power, political power, like you're the president of the United States or whatever, and have you try to address climate with the political ramifications, just so you can realize all the issues with trying to do that. Like, for example, you could say, well, I'm going to basically force everyone to buy an electric car. What are the implications for that? I want people to realize how difficult it is, the situation really is, to change. Someone joked that in the climate trail, there are three levels of difficulty, and they're done by temperature warming: 4 degrees centigrade, 5 degrees centigrade, 6 degrees centigrade warming. I have never completed the 6 degrees centigrade warming game, but people have, so I know it's possible. It's extremely hard. So one joke I had is we could have a 2 degree centigrade warming and all you do is get in your car and drive. But that's not exactly a game. The other thing is resources. I basically funded the game myself. What I said to my wife was, we're not going to have to contribute any money to the organizations this year. We're going to use the money we would have contributed to organizations to produce this game. I worked with artists I'd worked before in the mobile game space and with a musician who's extremely well known, who I've known since the early 80s. And everyone gave me the best deal they could. They had to pay their people. But still, it was a lot of money and games are expensive to produce. And I am now focused on making incremental improvements to the game. But most of my focus is getting the word out. Almost got the New York Times to cover it. Kind of sad that the editor decided not to do it, even though the reporter wanted to. But I'm working on other newspapers. I believe next week a major Canadian paper will run a story about the game. Because it's like the tree falling in the forest. If no one hears a tree falling, does it matter? We have thousands of people playing the game right now. It has 5-star reviews, the highest it can on all the app stores. But I need to now get the word out. So my job right now, before I build a new game, is to make improvements in this game and to do whatever I can to get the word out. The game is suitable for schools. There's no violence. There's no blood. And the gameplay is adequate for casual players as well as experienced players, which is why we have multiple levels.
I will do what I can to get the word out.
And I view this podcast as a way of sort of training myself to talk about the game, because eventually I will probably, unfortunately, travel and give talks about it, because it's important that people know what happened here. There have been games in the past that have made an impact. Games particularly have not done that well at addressing social issues, but there are some that have, and I want this game to be one of those as well. A serious game, but that is enjoyable, but gets people to think and feel Climate Trail. And feel is important.
So you're putting an incredible amount of effort into this. Are there personal motivations that you have?
Yeah, I have 3 children, for one. I'd like them not to have wake up 20 years from now and have a terrible situation. You know, one of them lives in the Pacific Northwest. They're having fire problems. The other one lives in Cape Cod. They just had this heck of a storm, pretty much unprecedented storm hit them the other day. I think yesterday or the day before. I want the world not to be a disaster. Unfortunately, I think they are going to have to live through a pretty tough world. I think, as I said, the depressing thing about the game is the research behind the game led me to conclude that we are not going to meet the 2-degree centigrade warming goal of the IPCC. There doesn't seem to be any way that's going to happen if you look at the trend in terms of carbon emissions and feedback loops. It's just not possible at this point.
I think the most likely scenario is that it gets to a point that is so bad that people put true effort into solving it because it's so bad, which will be too late to keep it from getting much worse.
Exactly.
But the sooner that happens, the least worse it'll get.
Yeah, this
the peak will be lower if they start sooner.
This is the discussion I have with my wife, who's pessimistic and had been pessimistic before I was. I say to her, you know, Leia, what we need is a Pearl Harbor. You know, the United States was completely apathetic about World War II. People have no idea what the mood of the country was. But if you read articles and you see reports, there was a large Nazi movement in New York, for example. There was a large convention. There was a lot of people who didn't want refugees coming into the United States. And people did not care about the war in Europe or what was going on in China with Japan. But Pearl Harbor shook them up. Shook them up in a way. My dad served in World War II. Everyone showed up at the recruitment offices the next day because they wanted to fight, because they felt we had been attacked and it was serious. The problem is climate change is a sort of difficult animal in that for that to happen, it would be a disaster of such unmitigated size that would affect people here. For example, if let's say in 2022, Mumbai hits a wet bulb temperature of 36 degrees centigrade and there's, let's say, a million people die. That's a horrible situation. It could happen. Would that get people in the United States to make a change? Sadly, I don't know. It almost has to hit home before people will do something.
So I've used the World War II analogy a number of times. One reason is to talk about how it took Pearl Harbor to get us going. But the other is how incredibly fast we got going, how we spun up industry, how we created weapons, how people gave up their jobs and their livelihoods to help. That is the kind of thing we need here. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Pearl Harbor, as you said, the Pearl Harbor of climate change is not something that we may not be able to survive the Pearl Harbor of climate change.
Yeah, by the time something like that happens, is it really too late?
So I don't know how many of these technologies will come to fruition. But there's a company in San Diego, I've had them on the show. They're trying to use material science to put together a solar material at 1/10 the cost of the solar material of today. I'm just saying that's a chance.
No, that's awesome. Solar is awesome.
There's a company near where you live up in Carlsbad that takes organic waste before it goes to landfill from the garbage trucks. It takes the organic waste out of it, separates it, and turns it into biomethane. I talked to a company yesterday that has a technology, and I really hope they can deliver. It takes garbage and or plastic and converts it to electricity in a very, very clean way. And then the last thing, as far as carbon sequestration, also right here in San Diego, the Salk Institute has a harnessing plants initiative. They just won $35 million from Audacious Projects that TED Talks runs. And I interviewed somebody in New York that helped give them their first money to get them going. And what they do is they modify plants to hold on to more of the carbon that they absorb by putting suberin, a cork substance, into the root system deep in there, so that even when the plants are harvested or die, the roots keep carbon in the ground. So just a couple of things that I'm hoping.
One of the interesting things is what could really be the big 30%, 20% lower thing would be agriculture. But that requires people to make personal changes. Now, I was fortunate to have a situation when I was 29 years old, a medical scare that forced me to change my diet. So I've been on a very restrictive plant-based diet, mostly plant-based and then all plant-based for a long, long time. But that happened by accident, by fortuitous accident, because I didn't know. But people, getting people to change is really hard. There's a movie that just came out that was produced by James Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger called Game Changers. And it's mainly about athletes, but they touch on the climate aspect of it all. This is something that could happen that would make a big change without really inventing a new technology. It's the amount of carbon we're talking about is equivalent to the transportation sector. So the transportation sector is about 20% of all CO2. So agriculture is also about 20% of all CO2. But that would mean people would have to decide, this is important, I'm going to make my change. Would they? Everyone loves their steak, and believe me, I miss it too. But, you know, there you go. Once again, this is back to the circle, full circle back to the Pearl Harbor thing. Remember during World War II, my dad used to say they collected all the fats when they cooked, so they could give them to the military so they could turn it into nitroglycerine for weapons. I don't know if you ever heard that story. And they collected all the metal. People would go around collecting metal. And you couldn't get tires for your car. And you were restricted for how much you could drive, and gasoline was rationed. I remember during, right after 9/11, I kept saying, so when are we going to start rationing gas so we can cut off the funding for all this? It never happened. People seem to be very unwilling to make personal sacrifices. But you can't blame it on people. Once again, back to the airline analogy, work needs to be done to prevent airlines from putting carbon in the air. And to blame people for that is kind of unfair.
So a lot of things have to fall into place. I think we need the technology. Although we have a lot of technology that can help, I think we still need even better technology to help us. But we also need a lot of change. There was a time in my career where I did software tools, and they would help developers have an easier job of developing software. But people just wanted to use Emacs to edit their code. I mean, even that was hard for some people.
VI. Now we're really screwing everyone up because no one knows what the heck we're talking about.
But the point is that even though the tools were so much better, it was incredibly challenging getting people to change their behavior, even to something better. So
there's only two kinds of people who look forward to change: toddlers and toll booth collectors. And that's it. No one wants change. No one likes change. Change is hard. The software tool thing is interesting. I have a whole story about that, but I will say that people get comfortable with what they're doing, and it's hard to change because their level of comfort is so high. And the food thing is a difficult problem. People want to do what they want to do, and they also feel kind of affronted when you bring that up to them, and I understand that. I do love this film Game Changers, though. I recommend it highly because it features athletes who are at the prime of their performance, making the switch and actually improving their performance and extending their careers and all that. So that's kind of cool. That's a good film because it presents a model that people can identify with. Oh, these people are like super strong, and one guy is carrying 1,100 pounds on his shoulders for 30 feet or something like that to set a record. It's very moving, very impressive.
We've jumped all over the place a little bit. What I'd like to do is to have you put together a set of solid discussion points for how you talk to people that don't believe that climate change is real. Because to me, it sounds like you have a lot of data in your head. It would be great to hear you put together a few minutes of logical argument.
So the way I approach this is I start with a fact that is easily verifiable, and I keep leaning down the chain. So I say to them, do we agree that CO2 levels are at 415 parts per million? Do we think that's a real figure? Do you think people are lying about that? And some people might say, oh, they're absolutely lying. At that point, you know, you're kind of lost. You cannot change someone's mind about a situation when they have come to that conclusion other than means of logic. It's a famous quote. So you get to the point where you say, yes, CO2 is that. And go, okay, so let's take a look at the historical record. The historical record we have is from ice cores. Do you believe that's real? Do you think the scientists are making that up there? And no. And so then you basically go for that historical record and you show that the last time CO2 levels were this high, this was what the world was like. And then usually what happens is there's a professional climate denying industry. If you look at the 80s, there was a very large consensus on climate. New York Times ran a piece was about the lost decade, about how we had a chance to stop climate change in the 80s and we failed. And it's an interesting article. It talks about the period from 1979 to 1989. You have to refute each piece of evidence. And it can be tiring because the climate denial industry is so good at what they do. There's this meteorologist who passed away recently. I think he was a San Diego meteorologist. John Coleman was this meteorologist who railed against climate change. And he would bring up arguments that were superfluous. So what I try to do is stick to the very core argument. Yes, CO2 levels are 415. Human beings are the cause of that extra CO2. For example, volcanoes are like 1/100th the CO2 that humans create. I can point them to scientific papers. Then I prefer talking about geological records than models. Models are difficult. Geological records are easier because you can go back in time and know what the temperature was, know what the CO2 levels were, and you can correlate that and explain that to people. Basically, what you say is we are in a world where we are doing an experiment by releasing all the CO2 that has created a situation that hasn't existed for millions of years. This is what life was like then, and this is the sort of world we're creating for ourselves. And then you talk about effects. You say, it's not that climate change creates hurricanes, it just makes them stronger. And why they're stronger is because there's energy in the water. Then you talk about Arctic ice, you start talking about feedback loops. You have to walk the trail, so to speak, in the case of the evidential trail. In lawyer speak, you have to walk the evidentiary trail. Think of it as a trial. And the evidence is overwhelming. I don't like talking things like 97% of climate scientists agree, because that's appeal to authority. It's a logical thing you can do, but it's not really as strong as just talking the science. But the strongest argument is for things that happen now. You know, I was on the phone. My brother works as a meteorologist for New York City. I was on the phone with him when Superstorm Sandy hit. And I remember him saying to me, well, the subways haven't flooded yet. They haven't flooded yet. And then 20 minutes later, the subways have flooded. This is an event that wasn't supposed to happen, and it happened. And the storm over Bermuda that hovered over Bermuda for how long? It's pretty weird, strange stuff. It's not that you can pin it down, but more of this is happening. But what you can pin down is years of drought and no crops in areas of the world that are causing conflicts. One of my conversations with someone, he said, it's not so much climate change that's going to kill us, it's the bow shock from climate change. I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, a boat goes through the water, it creates a wave around it. That's the bow shock of the ship going through the water. What's going to happen is, that could happen is we could see a war. We could see, for example, a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan due to a terrible climate situation. For example, India could run out. They're running out of water. You know, they're close to running out of water in many of the cities. If that, you know, there's going to be resource wars that could hurt us. So that is true. One people who totally believe that climate change, anthropomorphic climate change is real and a real hazard is the U.S. military. U.S. military takes it very seriously. The naval base at Norfolk is going to have to be abandoned due to rising sea level. Miami floods on sunny days. And people who lived in Miami tell me this was not the case 20, 30 years ago. Ironically, I read an article the other day, I think it was 2 days ago, that the legislature in the Florida state legislature is now really serious about climate change, which is ironic because the previous governor, I think Rick Scott, he actually made it illegal, well, not illegal, but he banned state employees from talking about climate change. So he basically said there isn't any climate change. It's fake. It's a conspiracy. You can't talk about it. Now Miami is flooding really badly. I visited Florida for a family reunion a couple months ago, and it was like we were in South Beach, and we're thinking, and I said to Leah, this is all going to go away, all these beautiful buildings and stuff, because it's going to be the first city we lose in the United States due to sea level rise. But sea level rise is the least of our problems. That's the other thing. You know, everyone thinks sea level rise, so we lose these coastal cities. So we have to put a Amsterdam-type dike at the southern part of New York City. No, no. The worst part is the fires and the heat and the diseases and the drought and the food supply. You know, we're only, in the United States, maybe 4 days away from chaos. What I mean by that is suddenly food and energy disappeared, like blackouts lasted a month, or food disappeared from the shelves of the groceries. How long would it take for there to be chaos? Not long at all. We're a society that depends on instant access. You can see what happens when a storm comes by, the supermarket shelves empty. But that's just a storm. What if it happens for a long time? That's scary.
So as we spiral our way down into further depression, one of the things I'm also concerned about is that people are out there, especially politicians, talking about 2040 or 2045 as if we can wait until then to really get our legs under us and do something about this. But I'm thinking in 10 years, we're already going to have a different world than we have today.
Crazy story, but it actually represents what's going on here. I was at a conference in like 1994, a technology conference, and someone had a 12-foot helium radio control dirigible. And I had done a lot of flying radio control gliders, and they couldn't fly it because what they didn't understand is how delayed everything was. But I took the controls and I could do it because I understood that when I applied that throttle to that dirigible, the results weren't going to happen for another 10 seconds. It's called hysteresis. It's a delay. Everything you do takes time. And so I was really good. People would be walking the hallway and suddenly they'd feel, and it would be the blimp hitting them in the eye. And then suddenly I'd hit the vertical propellers and shoot the thing in the air. It was hilarious. I know that's a silly analogy, but it actually is a correct analogy in the sense that the CO2 that's in the air now takes us to a level that's much worse than now. It's delayed. Most of the warming's in the oceans. The oceans can only absorb so much warmth. The corals are dying because the oceans are acidic because they've absorbed that warmth. They've created carbonic acid. They're bleaching the coral. If we kept CO2 at 415 and did nothing else, we'd still see warming go past 2 degrees centigrade. People don't get how delayed these reactions are. So talking about 2040 is a joke.
In life, we don't have the experience of delayed reaction very much.
Yes, we do. We do.
Well, we're not good at delayed reaction. We're really, really bad at it. We're used to driving a car and you turn it and it turns.
People smoke. People eat food that gives them heart disease. It's a delayed reaction. There's a thing called...
How about saving for retirement? People have a hard time saving. That's a future thing, right?
There's a thing called the tragedy of the commons, which I know was created for false reasons. The actual history of the tragedy of commons is not what it really is. But the idea is simply this. People will take short-term gain over long-term benefit every single time. It's human nature. So in the story of the tragedy of the commons is the towns used to have a common area where people could graze their cattle for free, their pigs, their cattle, their chicken, and people would overgraze it and suddenly it would be worthless. People do that in their own personal lives. We eat food that we know isn't healthy for us because we're not going to, if I eat a Big Mac today, it'll feel, taste great and it won't kill me today. It's not like I eat the Big Mac and I keel over. I keel over 20 years from now. Like I said, I was blessed when I was 29 because I got an insurance exam that said your cholesterol is the fruit of yin yang, and they sent me to a spa and I saw videos of what this thing does and scared me enough to make a change. And that's why last Sunday I was able to ride 65 miles on the bicycle and 5,000 feet of climbing because, and I'm 62 years old, because basically I got scared and gave up short-term gain for long-term benefit. But even that's been a struggle. I still screw up. And, you know, I talk to people who smoke, powerful addiction, they know it's going to kill them, They smoke all the way through getting CPOD and the whole bit. It's very hard human nature to give up short-term benefits for long-term gains.
What's interesting to me is that potentially the climate trail, the game, is a way to see the results of your actions without having to do the actions in real life, so that potentially you can learn. That's an appealing thing about these types of games. You get to experience a long period of time and see what happens, an adventure, without really experiencing it and potentially learning from it.
Right. One of the game inspirations I had was a game by Naughty Dog called The Last of Us, which is about a zombie apocalypse. There are so many games about zombie apocalypse.
I'm glad I played that one, because now I'm prepared if there is a zombie apocalypse. I'm just kidding.
But exactly right. There's, like I said in one of my writings, there are so many games about zombie apocalypse. How would a game about an apocalypse that could or is likely to happen? But the thing about, I also said to my gaming friends, God, if I had $100 million like or $200 million, whatever the budget for The Last of Us, I would do The Last of Us. And in fact, the fact that there's a younger lady and an older mentor in the game is absolutely lifted from The Last of Us. I stole that idea from The Last of Us because I thought that was brilliant. You know, he's there to protect her, and they travel to try to find something and all that. It's a traveling game. But it's a $200 million budget or something. It's a glorious game, and I didn't have that kind of money. Yes, I do present facts. I do present a gameplay, but what I'm also trying to present is people. People who basically, in this case through text, talk about their experiences and about what happened. And at the very end, there's a surprise. If you get to Canada, there's a surprise where they talk about something that's important, which is the fact that even if they get to Canada, it doesn't mean they're safe. Because climate change is global, and even the places that are benefiting. Like, for example, today in Edmonton, I guess, Greta Thunberg is there, and the people who are in the gas and oil industry are openly mocking her. They're driving around buses with signs about how they love gas and oil and all that. You know, that's because they think, well, we're all north here. Our winters stink. So if it gets warmer, that's great. Well, yeah, for a while. You know, it doesn't work that way. It's not like there's parts of the place that are always going to be safe. No, eventually everything goes to crap if you let this continue.
Can you talk a little bit about your prior background?
Sure. My career can be summed up as a series of fortunate and unfortunate incidences. I was in graduate school at Maryland, winter of 79. I saw an ad for game testing. It said, test computer games, earn money. And so I took the job at a company in Baltimore called Avalon Hill, which was very well known for board games and wanted to get into computer games. So for that Christmas break, I tested games, most of which were conversions of mainframe text-based games, B-1 Nuclear Bomber, Nuke War, and so on. And I liked the games. And then I said to Avalon Hill, I think we can do games with graphics. I think we can do really better games. And this is the part in my career where I probably made the biggest mistake of my career, which is I started doing games for Avalon Hill, and they published them, and they made money, good money. I did a game called Conflict 2500, which was sort of a multiplayer, traditional Star Trek-type game inspired by an anime series called Spaceship Yamamoto, or Star Blazers, as is known in the United States. I did a first-person wireframe shooter called Voyager 1, where you actually had a 3D wireframe world and you encountered robots and shot them. And finally, along with someone from the Navy, I did an air traffic control game that sold for, in 1982, $25 for a 32 kilobyte program. That's equivalent to $72 today. Avalon Hill did the amazing box artwork. And then, but I had an Ivy League education. I had expectation of actually making really good money, so I decided I had to take a real job. So I took a job working on business software for a company called Rising Star. Stupid me didn't realize that the fact that my first game I ever wrote was published and made me money was a big deal. I just didn't get that. And I urge anyone who's in that situation where you just started doing games for fun or because you care about it and you start to make money, to believe you have to get a regular job and give that up is a mistake. Don't do it. But I did that, and then I basically got back into games with the Macintosh. In 1 month, I created a version of the first game I did, the second game I did, Voyager, but I called Pyramid of Peril, with shaded 3D, maze-like game, algorithmically generated game, which was 1984. That's pretty far ahead of its time. Also, it had a map that only showed you what you had explored. That was pretty cool. And then I did a bad luck thing. I did a game, the first Macintosh Flight Simulator, called Mac Challenger, the Space Shuttle Flight Simulator. I picked Mac Challenger as the name. Big mistake. I remember coming in that day and just feeling like, what? This is awful. But Mac Challenger was really cool. Probably the first flight simulator with after-action camera video playback. So you'd try to land the shuttle, and after the play, you could actually, in a sort of fictitious simulated video recorder, watch the playback from chase planes, from the ground, and all that. So that was a first. Then Aegis became a company known for Amiga software. We did a bunch of software for the Amiga. And that lasted for me to 88, when I took a job at Activision. At Aegis, I started playing with optical disc. I got to Activision in the summer of 88 as director of technology. And Activision's goal back then, it was actually called Mediagenic. They had done a name change to Mediagenic. They changed back to Activision at some time after that. And their goal was to recover from the great Atari video game crash of 83, 84. And they wanted technology. They wanted to prove themselves. And the first week I was there, box of floppies on the VP's desk, Dick Lehrberg, and I say, what's that? And he goes, some guys in Texas did this HyperCard title. Look at the title, it's called The Manhole. I go, this is brilliant. They've created a visual interface. There are no buttons, there are no controls. It's just click on what looks interesting. We should publish this, yeah. And then I say, you know, with music and all that, this could be a good CD-ROM title. And there was no CD-ROM titles out there, but Apple was coming out with Drive, so we built a CD-ROM version. That's the first CD-ROM title. And then for a couple of years, all I did was take that title, The Manhole, and build it for different machines. In Japan, there was a machine called the FM Towns and NEC-9801. We got it on the PC, blah, blah, blah. And then Activision almost shut down. Activision got hit with a patent judgment, the Magnavox Bar video game patent. When the company was moved to Los Angeles, we were down to 13 people. We had been at hundreds of people. But once again, look, the guy who took over Activision was Bobby Kotick. Bobby is now the chairman of Activision, but he took over Activision in 91, and he knew me from the Amiga, from the Aegis days, so he kept me around. And even though we had a title come out in 92 that was a stinker called The Lever Goddess of Phobos 2, Bobby believed in what we were doing, and it allowed us to continue and do the Return to Zork. Return to Zork succeeded because of Lever Goddess of Phobos 2, because we were all upset over the reception Lever Goddess of Phobos 2 got from reviewers. We decided to make the Return to Zork the most unfair adventure game in history, and it's cursed because of that. There are 4,000 videos about it. It is completely unfair. It's deliberately unfair, but it featured really cool technology. Return to Zork has a lot of video in it, characters talking to you, which was becoming big at that time. But what it had was a really cool interface. It had a situation where when things happened in the game, any object could be used of any object to bring up a sort of pop-up diamond menu that basically was a reverse parser. So you could do things like warm your hands over the fire, or feed the cow carrots, or dig the plant out with a shovel. You had all these options. It was very rich. Plus, it also recorded every conversation you had. The conversations were audio. And you could ask any character about what any other character had said. You could take photos of any location and show those photos to other characters, and they would talk about them. You could show your objects to a character, and they would talk about that. It was extremely rich interface. Ironically, one of the reasons I left Activision is that they had lost Cyan as a publisher. We had done two titles with Cyan, the people who did The Manhole. Cyan had gone to Broadabun and done Myst, which was the biggest selling title of all time. And Activision was more interested in doing a Myst-like title than continuing with the sort of rich interface that was in Return to Zork. That, and in 94, I was offered a position with a San Diego company called the Lightspan Partnership to do education. Now, at this time, I have two young children, and I'm concerned about education, so I decided that this was a noble crusade to build educational software. So I left Los Angeles, Manhattan Beach, moved to San Diego in 94, summer of 94, and I took on the position of chief technologist at Lightspan, running development and QA and production. And then Lightspan had a public offering in February of 2000 with a market capitalization of close to $1 billion. And then a month later, the entire stock market collapsed, which is the biggest moment in my life. I'd taken a stint doing the technology behind an online coupon thing, of all things. I was the CTO of Save.com, but in early 2000s, I had to do something. And so I moved into mobile games, worked at a company briefly called Technic, and did a 3D Amazing that didn't go anywhere. And then the most random event ever happened, which is this. Early 2004, people from Lightspan come to me and they say, we have a license for a game called Yo Mama. And what we want to do is build a game where fat mothers fight each other in a boxing ring. And I say to them, possibly the worst idea I've ever heard of. You cannot do this. This is terrible. Let me think of something. And so what I came up with was, let's do a card game based on Yo Mama insults, where the cards have a Yo Mama insult and a point value. And we'll do a card game based on that. So we built the cards, and we started working on the mobile game. And then the most crazy random thing happened. We go to Comic-Con in 2004, and at the Topps booth, Topps people do bubblegum and baseball cards, are the Wayans brothers. And they have a game called The Dozens. And it's a card game of Yo Mama insults with point values. They did the same game. And everyone's in a state of panic. And I'm the CEO of this company, the company called Bonus Mobile. Sherry Kuno, who I worked with for years, is also in the company. She's the technologist. I say, don't panic. Don't even tell them we have a game. Let's get the mobile rights to The Dozens. And so we do. And Sherry Kuno, C-U-O-N-O, she did this technology that was amazing. This game ran on everything. You could play it with text messaging. You could play it with what was called WAP, mobile web. You could play it in J2ME. You could play it in Brew. On the fancier versions, it had animated cards. On even the web version, you had in-game chat. But even the text message version will let you play a quick game of four cards. And it had viral invites. This was unheard of. You could invite someone just by typing in their phone number to get a text message, and they could decide to play you, and the game would be delivered to them. This is, remember, literally 4 years before there was an app store. Well, and at the time, Bonus Mobile had some interesting problems internally, and we didn't have the money to really market it on the actual phone platforms. We had to basically come up with a lot of money to get Verizon and the rest to cover the game. And so that all blew up. Bonus Mobile blew up, and that was sad because that was probably the closest I came to building a massively successful, large company. So then we're sort of, Sherry and I leave, and we form a company called MyNumo, and we do a ringtone portal so that artists can publish ringtones. Hence the story of me sneezing on the phone and coming up with something called Rootones. That was at Bonus Mobile. And then we heard the iPhone was coming out, knew very little about it. We didn't have an app store for a year. iPhone had no app store, had no apps for a year, but it had the web. So we came up with this idea of doing a web-based game of having the chairman of Microsoft pop out of holes, and you would tap him. A whack-a-mole game with Steve Ballmer. And we got the game working before there was an iPhone. And then when the iPhone came out, we were on the phone desperately with people getting it tuned. And so the weekend the iPhone came out, iWhack came out, and it's literally the first iPhone game. And I worked on the design, Sherry implemented it. So we actually did the very first released iPhone game. And that company, MyNumo, became PlayScreen, and I worked there all the way through 2016. Got a job in early 2018 as a researcher for people I'd worked with briefly in 2000 doing research for a consumer product. And I'm using my science background for the first time, but that's all I can really say about it because it's a cool product, but it can't be talked about. But it's cool to be able to use my science. And that's when I realized in June of this year that, you know, I could apply all that game experience, decades of game experience, to building this climate game, and that's what happened. So that's my career in a very tough, you know, sort of roundabout way, yeah.
And so from that, what would you consider as your biggest setback, and what was your biggest success?
Well, Return to Zork is the biggest success because the company was in Chapter 11. Activision was down and out. Bobby Kotick had taken over the company brilliantly, and we were down to 13 people. We moved to Los Angeles in 92, and Return to Zork was a crapshoot because it was an expensive title for the day. Nowadays, it's a joke. I think it was a $700,000 budget. The company was in Chapter 11. Return to Zork ended up doing about 40 million units, and it became a very well-known title that was very profitable, and it started the process. There were two other titles, I think, that helped Activision turn around. One was MechWarrior 2, and the other one was Lost Treasures of Infocom. Not Lost Treasures, the Pitfall Harry remake was a big success. But Return to Zork was pivotal in the resurgence of Activision. So it's kind of cool to have started Activision in 88 when our annual revenues were like $70 million, and to look today and see Activision with revenue north of $7 billion. I'm proud of that a lot. And I think the biggest disappointment absolutely has to be The Dozens, because that should have been Zynga. That should have been Zynga. Here was a game that was everything you wanted in a mobile game. Yeah. So there's pictures of me at E3. You know, we had a booth at E3. The Wayans are there. It was great.
Can you talk about your climate change vision of the future?
Well, you know, it was so much more optimistic before I started this title. I feel kind of bad about that.
So you started in June.
And in June, I was like, we're going to have a Pearl Harbor incident, and we're going to go crazy and build wind turbines throughout the entire swath of land from Texas to Canada, because that equals the wind energy of the entire United States times X. The energy we use times X. We'll build smart grids. We'll put in all sorts of storage systems. We'll get us totally on renewable electricity. We'll make electric cars super cheap like they did in China with huge rebates. We'll get people to, we'll change the way we grow things. So livestock will be grown by grazing off the land, and there'll be a lot less of them. It'll be more expensive, and we'll blah, 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 blah. And then I realized, oh my God, it's so late.
So June through October, that's 4 months. You took 4 months. You've created a game.
I created the game in, the first version went out at the end of August. So I did it in June, July, and August. I did it in 2.5 months. The hardest thing doing the game was the scrolling map, because it involved a little bit of calculus, like, and the map scroll was not originally in the game, but it was basically demanded by the users right off the bat. And so the map scroll was the most complicated thing in the game, and it turned out to be a calculus problem. Since I have a degree, basically equivalent of a master's in physics, it wasn't too hard to do, and that was the most difficult thing. And I watched play of Oregon Trail on YouTube with people commenting on it. And I was trying to distill what the essence of Oregon Trail was. And the essence of Oregon Trail and the essence of Climate Trail is smart decisions, rationing. Rationing and smart decisions, like, do I travel during the storm? Do I travel during this heat wave? How much food and water should I be using? Blah, 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 blah. But I added some very clever things from my adventure game experience. As I say in the game, you need to be kind to people. I'm just going to leave it at that. There's a surprise that happens in the second half of the game.
You have to stop talking about the surprise or it won't be a surprise.
All right. I'm not going to talk about it. But you'll find out there's twists in the game that come from my adventure game background. And I'd like to expand upon that. If I do anything to the game, I'm going to basically have characters espouse more about the past and what happened, because I think that's important. But I also want to basically add more adventure-like things in them, so that besides the actual grind of like traveling to cities and deciding how much to eat and wherever to travel in storms, that there's some other play things involving interaction with the characters and stuff. I'm limited because I spent most of the money on art. And even that was a bargain. The beautiful art that everyone loves, that took cash. The music comes from a really great musician, and he was very fortuitous. So I have the music and all that. Would love to have it be narrated by voice and have voice actors talking to people about that. There's people who want to do translations and blah, blah, blah. But I've spent a lot of money on this. I really, now my feeling is, got a game, has all 5-star reviews. People tell me they like playing it. Really need to focus on getting the word out and not focus on tweaking, because that can come, but until people know about the game, what good is it?
Okay, I'm going to re-ask this question because we went way off topic. With regards to climate change, what is your vision of the future?
Oh, boy. Honestly, because of what I see happening in the world politically and all that, I'm thinking about where the heck am I going to relocate so I don't suffer the worst of it. I mean, I'm really at that point. But let's try to put a little veneer of optimism. There will be an event that scares people enough for them to make change. And we are certainly capable as a nation and as a world of mobilizing as we did in World War II. I believe we have enough technology to solve the electrical problem. Wind turbines now produce electricity at extraordinarily competitive prices. Storage becomes less of an issue if you build a smart grid, i.e. a grid that doesn't require synchronization, a grid that allows power distributed all over the continental United States and Canada. And then what we can do is go into the production of wind turbines the way we produced tanks and planes during World War II. The swath of land between, as I said before, between Texas and Canada is ideal. It's not extremely built up. Farmers can still farm around that. And you could literally run wind turbines all along that way. You'd have 24/7 power, pretty much. Smart grid would mitigate that stuff, and you could just storage where it's necessary. And decentralized solar makes a lot of sense as well. All the people in Northern California who had solar, if they had batteries attached to that, they would have been able to succeed. I think battery technology research. Now, on the esoteric side, even though some people are anti-nuclear, I'm not anti-nuclear. I'm anti what we have now for nuclear, the San Onofre plant being an example of what can go wrong. There is some technology, salt-based reactors, that can actually run on the waste we have now. So we have nuclear waste. We don't know what to do with it. There's reactor technology that could run on that. But we have to realize that's something that takes 10, 15, 20 years to happen. Like I always joke about fusion. Fusion energy, 20 years away since 1979. You know, it's constantly out there. someone asked me, what's the problem with fusion energy? And I said, the physics is hard. Some things are not easy. So my point being is, if wind turbines and solar are cheap as they are, and they apparently are, because if you look at the price that people are selling electricity they make from that, I mean, there's a town in Texas where at night you don't pay for electricity because they have too much wind. We know how to do smart grids. We know how to do wind. We know how to do solar. That problem is solvable. The hard problems are actually behavioral problems. If we can get people to accept the fact that meat's going to be expensive, I don't think we eliminate meat, but if we grow meat in a way that doesn't release CO, doesn't increase the carbon output, which means instead of having the massive feed pens and massive houses of chickens doing about one-tenth the animal livestock, and they're just wandering around the fields, helping to fertilize the fields, we go to sustainable agricultural processes that can actually sequester tremendous amounts of carbon. It's like a win-win. You're growing crops, and you're not producing CO2 because you're not using natural gas to generate fertilizer. All the fertilizer comes from natural gas. You're growing crops that are not releasing carbon. And in the process, you're actually sequestering tremendous amounts of carbon into the soil. You're getting better food. People are healthier and happier. And you still have livestock, but your steak and stuff has just become a lot more expensive. That doesn't happen immediately. That could happen. I think we're going to sail past 2 degrees centigrade warming no matter what. I think we'll come close to 4 degrees or exceed it. We're going to have to do a lot of mitigation, like water, sea level rise. We're going to have to be facing serious forest fires. So we're going to need to start building technology for that. We're going to need intelligent drones that can fight fire when they start. We're going to need to have superb monitoring of forests. We're going to have to put sensors all over the forest to see when the fires start so we can catch them. I was actually in a situation a couple months ago when the Paradise Fire occurred, where I had my little folding bicycle in the back of a car with someone else, and we had gone to a Camarillo for a meeting. And during the meeting was stopped because people said, look, look, look. And we could see the fire jumping over the freeway. So we got into the SUV to go home, and we were stuck in traffic. I said, let me out. So I rode through the smoke to the Amtrak station. The Amtrak was still running, and got the Amtrak to go home to Oceanside, to Carlsbad. That was pretty spooky. I have pictures of how bad the smoke was. It wasn't fun to breathe that in.
It sounds to me, from a vision perspective, that you think it's going to get very bad, but you believe in humankind, and so you believe that we will leverage the technology and the behavior change that we need and ultimately survive.
It's not a yes or no thing. It's a roll the dice thing. It's like a D&D game. You know, can you make a saving roll of 20? Because odds are we won't. That's the sad part.
I hope it's not just 20 that gets
saved. But I think the odds are we won't. But you got to make the effort. Look, World War II was pretty crazy and hopeless as well.
There were moments we thought we were going to lose the war.
Yeah, Midway was amazingly lucky.
Absolutely, that was the end right there for us.
Code breaking the Japanese code, knowing the Japanese were going to attack Midway, doing the right thing at Midway enabled us to. Midway is where Japan lost the war.
But it was at the last second, really, before they mobilized against us in the ocean, that we found their ships to attack, and that was barely in time.
Right, barely in time.
Do you have any questions for me?
What are people telling you who are scientists about climate change and how bad it is? Because I'm biased now, because in my research, I read a lot of papers, research papers, and they're all basically saying that the IPCC is wrong. We're going to sail past 2 degrees centigrade warming. What are you hearing?
The same thing. Sorry, I can't really educate you further on that. Just that everything that's published officially puts the best face on what's going to happen, even though it's really bad. But that privately, the research that they can't defend 100% has all these secondary and feedback loops that make the situation much worse.
Yeah. Greenland's ice melt now is what they predicted 50 years from now.
Everything is accelerated.
Yeah. And back to this original, the game itself, what I'm trying to do is what On the Beach did to me as a child. Scared the crap out of me and get me to think really hard about what this means. The other thing is, you know, like I took control of myself, you know, when I was young, and I got myself into what I consider to be pretty good health. So I get to get a ringside seat to this. I used to think, well, you know, before anything happens, I'll be gone. But I don't think that's the case. And I'm glad it's not the case. I want to be around. I want to fight the fight. And the thing is about World War II is, like you say, people didn't think we were going to win. People thought we were defeated or going to be defeated. We weren't super optimistic. We were just willing to do the effort because we didn't want to lose. And I think we need that attitude, which is, it's equally dangerous to sink into an attitude of all is lost, the heck with it. There's a couple people, environmentalists, I know there's one guy in England who's just retreated to the woods and he says, I give up. I give up fighting the fight. I give up talking to deniers. I just going to move into the woods and live the best life I can. There's a woman who talks, there's a Buddhist who talks about accepting our extinction. This is all well and good to have a good attitude about things, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't fight. I think you should continue to fight all the way to the end. As someone once said, the last day of the human race, I want to be able to plant a tree. Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say?
Just as a note that theclimatetrail.com is where you can find where the game is, but it's on the Apple App Store. It's on the Android Google Play App Store. It's on the Amazon App Store. It's available for the PC and the Mac on itch.io, but you can find that out on theclimatetrail.com. And it will be available on Steam shortly as well. I wanted to make sure it was widely available. It should run on Chromebooks. It should run on mobile phones. It runs on the PC and the Mac and Linux systems as well. We can't leave the Linux people out. So it's completely free. There's no reason not to play it and enjoy it and to learn something from it. So please do.
You are a really smart guy and you blow me away. I just want to say that. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up and I'm going to do it with a rap. Well, just like me, William's from New York. His biggest game was returned from Zork. His brother's a meteorologist. He predicts the weather every day. And his wife used to work for the EPA about the climate trail. We got the scoop. The scariest thing is the feedback loop. What we have now is a worldwide fail, which is why he coded the climate trail. The clock is running and it goes tick-tock. Don't forget about the bow shock. It's gonna be hard to get a lot of traction because humans just don't understand delayed reaction. It was an incredible decision when William went to Activision. William's really proud of the Zork interface, and he had the first product in the iPhone space. The problem is that luxuries are what humans crave. We just don't know how to change how we behave. The potential for survival is not illusion. We have the technology, just not fusion.
Very good. You missed your career. You could have been a rapper.
William's advice, urging people that develop games for fun and enjoy and care about it and have some success to resist the pull to leave the industry for a regular job. It's very important advice. When I graduated from school with a BS in math and computer science, I went to a great company, Tandem Computers, but I did not follow my dream, which interestingly enough, and why I'm talking about it now, was to code computer games. I even had a couple of innovative ideas, but I think William did all of them. While he's now left the gaming industry, at least when it comes to making a living, he's using his own money and time to bring a free new game to market that educates people about the causes and effects of climate change in a fun way. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change, and after this podcast, I'm sure it's a very serious concern, for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want a release from some of life's stress, or just to improve your speaking skills, consider taking an improv workshop at an improv club in your town. William has combined his drive to help the world, his excellent game development skills, and his passion to innovate to launch the Climate Trail, where you can experience what it might be like in a post-climate changed world without having to suffer through the actual experience. He was recently featured on Gizmodo in a story written by Yesenia Funes. Search for any combination of Funes, Volk, Gizmodo, that's G-I-Z-M-O-D-O, and climate to find it. The Climate Trail is available for download for free. It's on the Mac, Windows, and Linux, as well as in the Apple Store and Google Play for mobile. William talks about people that have accepted the fate of climate change and are retreating from the battle. But as William says, we need to continue the fight all the way until the end. And together, we can mitigate climate change.